And now, from Washington, the Inside Scoop. All the news the government does not want you to hear. Now, here's your host on the Inside Scoop, Mark Levine.
Good afternoon, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. Did you watch the President's State of the Union speech last night? You didn't? I'm not surprised. I wouldn't have watched it, except, well, you know, I have to. It's part of the downside of being a talk radio host. But don't worry, you didn't miss anything. It was interesting, though, for me to see the tone of the President's speech. Really, what he has to say has long flown out the window. So it was interesting just sort of watching him stand up there. And it was kind of weird. A lot of the swagger that the President had formerly shown was gone. Sure, he continued to do that in private. We'll talk about that this hour, the sneaky stuff he's doing on the telecom immunity bill, the foreign surveillance bill, and all the ways he's still trying to screw us over in his personal ways. But as far as his own self up there, he really seemed like he was trying, at least in tone, to reach out to the Democrats. Now, as usual, the way Georgie does something is not with full heart, and it was clear that he wasn't happy about it. And I don't know, there was something pleasing for me seeing George Bush not in full swagger mode, a bit emasculated, recognizing that the entire country was focused on who his successor would be. It's not just the Democrats. It's not just Obama and Clinton and Edwards that consider George Bush a failure. It's also his own Republicans. Mitt Romney, Mike Huckabee, John McCain, Rudy Giuliani, Ron Paul. Are any of them big fans of the president? No, not a single one. All of them are dangerous and, extreme in their own ways. But there's still none of them will talk about the Bush legacy. What will be George W. Bush's legacy? How do you possibly talk about the last 7 years? I mean, I remember when Ronald Reagan was president, and I thought, wow, you know. Actually, I should say I go back to when Jimmy Carter was president. I was still a little kid. But I remember thinking, boy, this is the worst possible president we could have had. And then came Ronald Reagan. I thought, well, that's the worst president we could have. And then came George Herbert Walker Bush. And I remember distinctly thinking, wow, he's worse than Reagan. This has got to be the worst president in American history. And then came Bill Clinton. We'll talk a lot about Bill Clinton tomorrow. Tomorrow, by the way, I'm going to do my official endorsement for President of the United States. I will officially make my endorsement. I encourage all of you to tune in tomorrow. You still have one last chance to talk me out of it today or tomorrow. But I'm pretty sure who I'm going to endorse. I'll leave it, though, till tomorrow for you to find out. But Bill Clinton's presidency was a change. Here was, as I've often admitted, the best president of my lifetime. Now, I realize that that's a very low standard to set. You know, when you look at the other presidents, Nixon, Ford, Carter, Reagan, Bush and Bush, to say Clinton is the best president of my lifetime, I guess, isn't that much of an achievement. But still, he is, and he was. And then came George W. Then came George W. Ronald Reagan famously said in his debate with Jimmy Carter in 1980, "Are you better off than you were 4 years ago?" So it's very simple to ask America, are we better off than we were 7 years ago? Is there anyone in the world that will say we were better off than we were 7 years ago? The most ardent defender of Dick Cheney, maybe the lawyer who he shot, and was still, I'm so sorry, Master Dick, I got in the way of your gun, said the lawyer. Would he say we're better off than we were 7 years ago? Look at the economy. Look just for a moment only at the economy. You can look at the failure of the federal government to regulate banks that have gotten us into this subprime mess with deceptive mortgage practices. Or you can simply look at the fact that we have the largest national debt by far in American history. $9 trillion. 9 trillion dollars. When I was studying economics in college, they talked about the incredible national debt that at that time might exceed $1 trillion. And we're nine times worse in less than 20 years. Whatever you think about Bill Clinton, he gave us the highest surplus in American history. Also, increased poverty in America. We're the richest nation on earth. We have more uninsured than ever before. We have more poor people than ever before. A very tiny selection of the American populace is getting richer, those at the top. And everyone else, middle class, poor people, are getting poorer. In fact, it gives you some indication of the powerful differences between rich and poor in America to note that the average income really hasn't changed much. And yet, 80 to 90% of us have seen our incomes decrease. Wow, the people at the top are really making out. You can't talk about the State of the Union under George Bush without talking about the Iraq War. The never-ending Iraq War. The war that John McCain says will continue for 50 or even 100 years. A war in which George Bush sees some progress, but has a hard time understanding what the word progress means. See, it all depends on where you set the goalposts, folks. If you say that, heck, they're not killing thousands every day now, they're killing only dozens a day. Is that progress? Is that the goal? If the killing, all the killing in Iraq were to stop, and no one, including John McCain, says that's the case, what would we have accomplished? $1 trillion, almost 4,000 American lives, tens of thousands of Americans irreparably wounded, lost a leg, lost an arm, tens of thousands more, up to a third of all American veterans with post-traumatic stress syndrome, waking up in the middle of the night screaming. Hundreds of thousands of Iraqi civilians, not terrorists, not insurgents, not people setting bombs under American cars, not Shias out to kill Sunnis and Sunnis out to kill Shias, maybe some of them, but hundreds of thousands of Iraqi civilians dead, gone, in a country that's, you know, a few tens of millions. And in that same country, millions gone. Exiled, left, looking for something better. Why are we in Iraq? Why are we in Iraq? George Bush, in his entire State of the Union speech, would talk about, oh, the progress that's being made. You know, the violence is going down. He even talked about the grassroots Sunnis that are joining together to protect themselves, not mentioning that they're paid $300 a month by you and me, U.S. taxpayers, to join George Bush's propaganda army. You think they'll stay when the money dries out? I don't think so. What have we accomplished? Are we safer now than we were 7 years ago? Saddam Hussein was a menace in the way that, you know, a fly on the wall that buzzes around a lot in my house is a menace. It's annoying. He was annoying. But with no fly zones and an effective independent Kurdistan in the north, he was pretty well contained. He was much weaker than he was at the time that he invaded Kuwait. And when you think about it, we've had much more powerful enemies, the Soviet Union, much more dangerous enemies, China. We never invaded them. Heck, I could throw Pakistan into that mix. In fact, I think an argument could be made that Saudi Arabia, the country whose feet George Bush kisses metaphorically and whose cheeks he kisses literally, that country is more dangerous to us than Iraq. What did we achieve? What is our progress? And please don't tell me the progress is that less people are being killed now than they were a year ago. That's a weird kind of progress. That's the kind of progress where you make an investment in a swamp pit. You make an investment in the swamp and it costs you millions. millions and millions of dollars, and every year you lose millions and millions of dollars, and you say, should I withdraw my investment? And the financial advisor says to you, no, we're making progress. Why, last year you only lost $100,000. The years before, you lost several hundred thousand dollars. We're making progress. Such is our progress in Iraq. We haven't achieved anything on the oil front. Even if you can argue, and I think, frankly, the only logical argument for why we're in Iraq is because it is the second largest oil source in the world. They have incredibly sweet crude, and when they use the word sweet, you know what they're talking about is the profits that the oil companies can make. For $1, you get $60 worth, $70 worth, now close to $100 worth. But what has that achieved? Even for oil, that's the thing that the New York Times talks about. Well, we can't leave Iraq now. It's the second largest oil producer. Even purely for oil, forget the lives lost. Forget the havoc ruined. Forget the generations of terrorists that we have created. Even if you just look purely at economic interest and you look at oil, that hasn't paid for the war. Exxon and Mobil are doing well, but our prices at the pump are still going up. We have more dependence on foreign oil than we did when George Bush became president. So why do we invade Iraq again? Why do we invade Iraq again? Our dollar is weaker than it's ever been before. I mean, when the Canadians have to cross the border to buy cheap, you know we're in trouble. Osama bin Laden's on the loose. Not just him, but Mullah Omar. Remember him? Nobody ever talks about Mullah Omar. Mullah Omar was the head of the Taliban. And my inside sources in the Pentagon tell me that actually he's much more dangerous than Osama bin Laden. That Al-Qaeda is mostly, it's an idea more than a group. Anyone can claim to support Al-Qaeda. That's one of the reasons why we have Al-Qaeda in Iraq. Who are they? They're Iraqis, mostly, who have joined up with the fight against the imperialist America. And they say, oh, we're joining Al-Qaeda. But they're not directed by Osama bin Laden. He's not a good guy. We should capture him. We should try him. We should convict him. And if everything against him is proven, as I'm sure it will be, he should be convicted and executed, as far as I'm concerned. But Mullah Omar is a greater threat. Mullah Omar leads a government in exile, the Taliban. The Taliban that so mistreated women in Afghanistan and that now is controlling huge swaths of Afghanistan and Pakistan. We never really talk much about capturing him. This administration, trying to figure out how do you discuss the State of the Union of this administration, the list just goes on and on and on. Treason. When's the last time you ever heard a president seriously been accused of treason? In this case, it's the vice president, outing a CIA agent for his own political gain. Think about that. Julius and Ethel Rosenberg in the 1940s were executed for their treasonous acts. They were executed because their spies were discovered. And now, Vice President Cheney's treason? Nobody ever talks about that. What is the State of the Union now, 7 years into Bush? You have to talk about the shredding of the Constitution. I mean, if there's one thing for which this administration will always be remembered, it's got to be that this is the administration that hates the Constitution more than any other. They hate the Fourth Amendment. They want to search without warrants. They hate the Sixth Amendment. They want to put people in jail without lawyers, without trial. They hate the Eighth Amendment. They want to torture people again and again and then shred the tapes of the people that we've tortured. The sad thing is that the list goes on and on. I can't tell you in an hour. I probably couldn't tell you in 3 hours what will be the legacy of this administration. The prosecutor scandal. Firing prosecutors who were not going after Democratic politicians. Hiring those that would. Firing those who were going after Republican politicians. Karl Rove being in charge of it all, Alberto Gonzalez covering it up. This is an administration that will always be remembered for the Midnight Massacre, when Attorney General Ashcroft, right-wing extremist he, still refused to break the law, and Alberto Gonzalez came in and tried to trick him while he was under sedation. This is an administration that will always be remembered for the dirty tricks of Karl Rove. Everything from McCain's black baby, supposed black baby in South Carolina, to making sure that black voters did not have enough machines in Ohio in 2004, leading to lines around the block and a Bush victory. And of course, no one can fail to mention how this administration came to power in the first place. The first in American history to come to power in a coup d'etat. And hopefully the last. No, none of this was in George Bush's State of the Union. None of it described how he's destroyed science in a way to accomplish his ideological ends, on how the so-called uniter, not a divider, has served to divide us all. So George Bush last night was looking for his legacy. But we know his legacy. It's a legacy of failure. Dave from California on the line. Welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Well, Mark, it's your pessimist, and I am indeed that. I have to admit to it. As we look at this administration, I detect even little hints of pessimism in yourself, Mark.
But I'm optimistic, Dave, about the future. Just because I can't find anything of value, or virtually nothing, in this administration, doesn't mean I don't have hope for the future. Please don't confuse those two things. I do have hope for the future.
Well, they're doing immense amounts of damage, and every day that goes by, it seems to get a little bit worse. But what are we doing in Iraq? And I include Iran, because I don't put that. I was 9/11 on Obama. But it's all about a plan that goes way back to the earliest days of PMAC. There is nothing.
I hope you meant Osama rather than Obama.
Did I say Obama?
You did. We've got to watch that, because if he's our nominee, the Republicans are going to, you know, make that mistake a lot. So, all right, go ahead. Go ahead, Dave.
It clearly was a mistake. I didn't realize I'd done it. But
go ahead.
Nothing at all that's credible about our involvement in Iraq. It is very profitable to Lockheed Martin and to Halliburton and to Bechtel and to the oil companies. Yes, it is that. But they talk about the improvements, the progress that's being made. What does that mean?
In their view, it means that less people are dying each day. It's like my example of the bad investment, where you're losing money, but less money than you lost the year before, and they call that progress. A less negative number, if you will.
Right. I think it means, really, that we're stealing more today than we were able to last year, and that we're taking more out of their ground, and we're taking more out of the treasury, and we're stuffing it into the pockets of Cheney's buddies, Halliburton. That's what it's all about. If there's any other reason for that war, I haven't got a clue as to what it is.
Well, the thing is that you'd think at least they get cheap oil out of it, right? At least. I mean, forget the loss of lives, forget weapons of mass destruction, forget terrorism, which has increased. At least you'd think we'd get cheap oil.
They're not paying for any of that oil. Who are they paying? The Iraqi people? I don't think so.
No, they can't even get an oil law passed in their parliament. Because basically we want all the money to go to our oil companies, and they don't. And you know what? I don't blame them. I don't blame them at all. But I'll tell you this. There's going to be a civil war between Shia and Sunni. It's already started. Yes, we can forestall it a bit. But it's going to happen when we leave. And it doesn't matter whether we leave today, or 4 years from now, or 10 years from now, or 20 years from now. And the question is all that money and treasure worth it? It is. Do you know how much we're spending a week in Iraq? I'm curious.
$3.5 billion, I believe, we borrowed.
Very good. Very good. Almost $4 billion a week. That's pretty good, Dave. Most people say, what, a million? A billion? No, almost $4 billion a week.
And that's being added to our treasury every week.
That's exactly right. And we're not paying for it. And when you think about you know, the state children's health insurance program, the one that Bush vetoed, the one that would guarantee every child, at least in America, some form of health care. That's 10 weeks in Iraq. And we're done for the year. For the year. And you have to wonder, where all the, I mean, because, you know, John McCain will tell you we have to be there 100 years. For all the rhetoric of the Republicans, which is more important? Whatever we're doing in Iraq, and again, I'm not sure what progress is being made. We make tactical progress, but not strategic progress. We, you know, we lower the violence here for, you know, a few weeks. But in terms of some, we're not exactly creating a model democracy in our image. It's not Germany and Japan after World War II, folks. So I don't know what we're doing in Iraq, but whatever we're doing, we're losing health care for children. We are making sure that people, that adults don't have health care. We are in a mortgage crisis. We have an economic problem. We have massive, massive debt that the people are going to have to pay for. And all our treasures go into Iraq.
And yes, I am a pessimist about all this, but may I say that on the other issue that you wanted to try to call and twist your arm and influence you, Edwards is the hope for this country, and I think you know that. He's got by far the best thinking. And if they don't totally rig the election, write him in on paper, because I believe they're rigging the election. You know that.
Yeah, but you believe that on every election, Dave. Is it possible that some elections aren't rigged? I mean, caucuses, for example, where the vote is public? I mean, look, here's my problem, Dave, is if you believe that every election is rigged, and, you know, it's hard to prove a negative. I can't prove that every election isn't rigged, though I can say that in caucuses you could check the numbers at home, right? I mean, that you see how many people are voting, and you could check with your precinct list. But there are paper records in some of these states. And, you know, the problem, I think, with making that argument is almost it proves too much. You know, there are times when I think elections are being rigged, and or at least capable of being rigged, and I'm afraid if we use that argument for every election, it loses its force. I mean, there's no real evidence of it except for the fact that the people you know don't agree with where the results are, right, Dave? I mean, you don't know of any particular. I mean, this isn't like Clint Curtis. I mean, I've had Clint Curtis on the air, who was trained to manipulate and change electronic data in Florida. That to me is some evidence. I mean, I just think, Dave, your evidence is you don't like the result, right?
Well, let me explain a logic to you, and I hope you will ponder it with me. And that is to say that at any point, no matter how they did it, caucus or whatever, at some point that data is accumulated and entered into a computer with a modem that can be readily invaded by these high-tech said hacker goons. So that's when we start getting the data, when that's in the computer and flipped all over the place. Take that away, and I do think you find Edwards and Kucinich way out front. I don't think even they know it. It's amazing to me that they don't. But
well, you know that did you know that Kucinich did a recount in New Hampshire?
And if they can rig the election, they rig the recount. But he didn't get very far with it. I think they ran out of money.
No, they ran out of money. But the part that, I mean, the precincts he did get, and I've looked at those numbers, and they're not different. In fact, the precincts he actually got slightly less. I mean, you know, less than 1% difference, but slightly less than he thought he'd gotten originally. And
well,
the numbers didn't.
Another point.
Go ahead.
Of logic, if I might.
Go ahead.
Is, do you feel that it would be beneath the character of this administration to rig elections if they could?
No.
No. They would be perfectly compatible with their basic core personalities and characters.
Well, yeah. No, I'm not saying it's beyond them. No, I'm not saying that at all.
And do you know that they get the most?
But I do think that paper records prevent rigging of elections. And I know that they are increasing. In fact, it may be more. I need to do another show on that before November. But I believe we're above 35 states now. We are getting somewhere. I mean, we're not there yet, and it's an important issue, no question. But I think it is getting harder to rig elections, and I'm very happy about that. It's one of the issues that I've cared about, and I know you've cared about for a long time. That's why I don't want to cry wolf here. If you had some evidence, you know, if Kucinich had discovered something, and that's why I didn't mind the New Hampshire recount, if he discovered something, fine, but he didn't. And I just think that before we make such an accusation, we need some evidence of it. And I at least in this election, in these primaries, look, if someone were going to rig an election, why would they have Obama win one and then Clinton win two and then he wins another? You know, it doesn't really make sense. I mean, if they were going to rig it, I mean, who's rigging it? If Clinton's rigging it, it should be she wins them all. If Obama's rigging it, he wins them all. You know, unless it's a Clinton-Obama conspiracy against Edwards, which I just don't buy.
No, me
I just don't buy.
I don't buy that at all, no. It's evidence. You know what is, to me, overwhelming evidence? When I look,
okay,
this is a democracy, and look at the caliber of people we've got occupying our White House. Would that happen in a democracy? Would it happen?
Well, no, of course not. I've already said the coup d'etat of 2000, which, by the way, the coup d'etat of 2000 is not a conspiracy theory. It's not conjecture. It's not, oh, I think they rigged the election. There's no question they rigged it because they rigged it in plain sight. All you have to do is read the opinion of Bush v. Gore. And in plain sight, they're saying, we're not going to count the votes. Bush wins. Shut up, America. Now, that's a theft that, you know, had 200 million witnesses. So no one can dispute that the election of 2000 was stolen. I'm just saying that I won't make such a charge unless there's some pretty strong evidence to that effect. In 2000, the evidence is overwhelming. There can be no question the election was stolen. In 04, there is some persuasive evidence. In Ohio, we've talked about the long lines, the fact that the blacks didn't have the voting machines the same way whites do. But I have never said definitively that I think 04 was stolen, because I think the jury's still out on it. But I will grant that there's very persuasive evidence on 04. And even I did a show, there's some evidence on 06. But I do think you have to base this on evidence and not merely on the fact that your candidate's not doing as well as you'd hoped.
No, it isn't simply that. It isn't simply that. I've had a great deal of firsthand exposure to these high-tech Fed goons that go in and invade our computers. I know what they're capable of doing. I know that the machines were designed so that they could do it. You've interviewed the fellow that was detained to do them, and it is also so totally consistent with the nature of the neocons.
It is, and I don't dispute that, Dave. All I'm saying is that today more and more states have paper records, and I don't think, barring, you know, stuffing the ballot box, which is hard to do these days when you have people from each party there watching the ballot boxes, I just think it's harder and harder to rig an election. I think that's a good thing, and I just don't want to make any charges that can't be backed up. But thanks for your call, Dave. I always appreciate when you do call. We're going to take a break. When we come back, there's two things I want to discuss. I want to talk about the telecommunications bill that's going to happen around the corner. Will the Democrats cave again? Well, people on the Hill think actually it's likely. But I don't know. I remain hopeful. And then I want to talk about the situation in Gaza and what's going on there. We'll be right back with more of the Inside Scoop right after this.
You're listening to the Head On Radio Network.
We know you want to save big on your phone bill, and we know how you can.
That's right. We do.
We're saving more than 50% on our home phone bill since we switched to CityNet's digital phone plan.
Really? Over 50%?
CityNet's digital phone plan is only $24.95 a month.
Only $24.95?
You get unlimited local and long-distance calling.
Just $24.95.
And with CityNet's digital phone plan, you keep your current number. All you need is a high-speed internet connection. Get details at citynet.net.
$24.95.
And, oh, this is cool. With CityNet's digital plan, I can use my home phone anywhere in the world with high-speed internet. No extra cost.
There's 20, and there's 4, and there's 95.
Did I mention CityNet is a West Virginia-owned company?
Did I mention $24.95?
Save at least 50% on your residential phone. Get unlimited local and long distance, and keep your same number, all for just $24.95 a month. Visit citynet.net today for more details. Some exclusions and restrictions may apply.
I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive Magazine, with my progressive point of view, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. The only noteworthy thing about Bush's State of the Union address was his unmistakable belligerence toward Iran. He mentioned that nation first in the context of why the U.S. must stay in Iraq, otherwise we'd strengthen Iran, Bush said. Well, he could have thought of that before he began bombing Iraq, but he didn't, and now he's back in a bombing mood. Never mind that the national intelligence estimates said Iran didn't have nuclear weapons and didn't have an active nuclear weapons program. Bush still raised the specter of Iran with a nuclear weapon. He castigated the Iranian government for opposing freedom wherever it advances in the Middle East, and he said Iran was aiding militia groups in Lebanon, the Palestinian territories, and in Iraq. It's the latter excuse that he's going to hang his helmet on. I'm betting that Bush will come to the American people once more before his term is up and declare that forces trained by Iran have attacked our troops in Iraq and that he therefore is going after them. Listen to his words. Above all, know this, Bush warned. America will confront those who threaten our troops. We who cherish peace, we who abhor imperial misadventures like Bush's Iraq War, must now pressure our elected officials to stop this madman before he wages yet another reckless war, this time in Iran. We can't say he hasn't warned us. I'm Matt Rothschild, and that's how I see it.
Don't touch that mouse. Strictly Confidential is LGBT Radio. 9 p.m. Eastern, right here on the Head On Radio Network.
Many colors in the homo rainbow. Don't be afraid to let your color shine. Many colors in the homo rainbow. Show me yours, I'm gonna show you mine.
From Washington, more of the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. We're talking about the State of the Union after the President's address yesterday. I also want to talk about the Intelligence Surveillance Act bill, and then I definitely want to get to the situation in Gaza. If you want to call in, the toll-free number is 877-4-HEAD-ON. I've been reading the comments on the blog. Robert is saying what's curious most of this State of the Union is what attack he has left, what the president with his ratings could have any voter capital to support him in anything. Robert writes that he was surprised how he states al-Qaeda is on the run in Iraq and ignores Pakistan and Afghanistan al-Qaeda, never mentioning Sunni-Shia violence. He says a lot more things that you can read about on the blog at RadioInsideScoop.com, but of course he never says, as Robert points out, when our people in the military will be coming home. Lastly, Robert says, Bush spoke of his last-minute endeavor to resolve Israeli-Palestinian differences. What he may do brings greater harm to the next president's opportunity to make progress. And Republicans whined that the Clintons trashed the White House when they left. Well, this president trashed America and left an ugly yellow rug in the White House. He trashed most of the world, for that matter. I'd also argue that he trashed throughout his presidency and not just when he was leaving. We have someone who writes in called The Historian who says that George Bush edges out William Henry Harrison as the worst president ever, and Harrison died his first 30 days in office. Look, it'll be interesting to see how historians rate the legacy of George W. Bush, but it's kind of hard to imagine that he won't be ranked at the bottom or very close to the bottom. I mean, how else do you judge a president? The economy, peace, the surplus, security, dependence on foreign nations, the Constitution. Is there any way in which George Bush has been a success? And speaking of the Constitution, one of the main ways in which George Bush has trounced the Constitution, one of the ways, in fact, more severe than any other, if only because it affects millions of us, is the fact that they're monitoring our phone calls and our email and our web usage. They do it through programs, computer programs like Carnivore, that claim to be very sophisticated in picking out certain words and phrases used by terrorists. My guess is they're not sophisticated by half. I mean, are they going to capture every email that says she's the bomb? Here's a clue. Terrorists probably don't use the word bomb. They use code words. How are we going to know those code words? I think there's a reason why the people we've captured who are planning terrorist acts in the last few years have been only those that are incredibly stupid. Remember the plot to blow up the Sears Tower by people who'd never been to Chicago and weren't quite sure where the Sears Tower was? Oh, I have no doubt it was real. I think those people probably did intend to do so. But they were lunatics, and they had no chance of actually succeeding. The real terrorists probably can't be captured by Carnivore, They're probably encrypting what they say, or even worse, using code words. Meanwhile, hundreds of millions of us are being spied on by our own government. Now, I know what some people say. I know what my Republican friends say. They say, well, I'm not doing anything wrong. I don't care if I'm spied on by the government. Really? Well, why not just look at the behavior of the vice president? Dick Cheney believes strongly in spying on every American citizen, and yet his emails are missing. The CIA believes in torturing people, and yet videos of their torture are missing. There's nothing more vital for the Democratic Congress over the next year, and they're not going to do much over the next year, than to hold Harriet Myers and John Bolton in contempt. A committee approved their contempt in July of last year, but the Democratic House, and this is entirely under Nancy Pelosi's control, they're holding up a vote. Well, they're working with the president on a stimulus package and blah, blah, blah. Fine. I'll give her another month. But we need to start calling our representatives and insisting on contempt. Let me tell you something. I talk with people in Congress all the time. They have the votes. It'll be pretty much a party line vote, but they have the votes to hold Myers and Bolton in contempt. It's just a matter of convincing Pelosi it's the politic thing to do. So let me ask all of you, please, to call your representative and ask them to move the contempt along. If you want to wait till after the surplus bill is passed, fine. That's sort of what Nancy Pelosi has said she'll do. But what does it mean? For all the Democratic Congress has done, the best thing they've done, and they've done some good things. I'm not saying they've done nothing. I think it's unfair to the Congress to say they've done nothing. I mean, the energy bill wasn't bad. They did raise the minimum wage. They did provide for good student loans. They're cutting the rates in half on student loans. They did fulfill the 9/11 Commission recommendation. So they've done some good things. But they need to hold Myers and Bolton in contempt. And the reason they do is that for a subpoena to work, there's got to be a threat of punishment. If Bolton and Myers aren't held in contempt, then what it means is that the president never needs to obey a single subpoena again. We have a lot of subpoenas to find out what went on. What went on with Scooter Libby? Was the vice president involved in treason? What went on with the prosecutors? Was Karl Rove choosing on a political basis? You betcha. But we need to see the smoking gun. When emails are destroyed, is anyone going to be held accountable? Whether it's emails about political decisions in the White House, about spying on Americans, or about torturing people. And related to all of this, I think, is the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Bill. Now, I've talked often in this show about the mechanics of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act as it existed prior to any changes in it. When George Bush became president, the FISA court, Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act court, granted more than 99% of the applications made to it. It gave a warrant, it found probable cause that's consistent with the Constitution, and bad people were spied on. And I have no problem with spying on bad people with probable cause and a warrant. In fact, under the law, you could even begin spying as long as you got retroactive approval within 72 hours. And to do that, you could wake up one judge at 3 in the morning. For the administration, this wasn't enough. And there's a reason why. The administration doesn't want to spy just on terrorists. It wants to spy on innocent people, too. It wants to find out what Quakers in Vermont are doing. Are they opposing George Bush's war? It wants to find out what innocent Muslims are doing in their mosque. It wants to spy electronically on people, hundreds of millions of Americans, without a warrant. Frankly, I don't understand why the FISA bill had to be improved at all. Now, there is one argument that I've heard, which is better than most, and that is that we do have the right to spy on foreigners completely. They have no rights under our Constitution. So if there's a conversation between an Afghani and a Pakistani, we can spy on it. It doesn't matter whether they're innocent or guilty. We don't need probable cause. And I do think that's constitutional, folks. It may not be a good idea, but I do think it's constitutional. In fact, I don't even really mind it so much. I kind of wish that we had some reason to believe they're involved in terrorism, but it is constitutional. So the argument was, well, if they use American telecommunications facilities, in other words, if a call between Afghanistan and Pakistan happens to get routed through Los Angeles, then we can't spy on that phone call. And that may be the correction that they wanted in the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. If so, it's a fairly minor thing. But you know what happened, right? The Democrats passed a wide-ranging bill. The president said that we're going to be in big trouble if we don't have this bill, even though we hadn't had the bill for years. But 6 months ago, the Democratic Congress was pressed, we need this emergency bill, and they gave it to the president. And even then, the president didn't ask for immunity for telecommunications companies. You know what he wants. He wants to say that if the president of the United States asks Verizon to get your grandmother's phone bill, and Verizon does it, that even though your grandmother has not committed a crime, and there's no reason to believe any probable cause she's done anything wrong, she can't sue the telecommunications company for giving up her private conversations. It could be anything from her cherished chocolate chip cookie recipe to the fact that grandma likes some kinky stuff on the side. It doesn't matter. I don't care. It's her private life. It's her private life. It's not the president's business. We don't live in East Germany. We don't live in the former Soviet Union. So the president wants to say that the telecommunications companies should not be held responsible if they happen to breach the Constitution and take away your rights. And the Democrats are saying, no, no, that doesn't make sense. In fact, sometimes the only way to catch the administration breaking the law is to sue the telecommunications company. One of the things I learned in law school is that the only way to attack the British Crown, way back before the United States existed, when there were the beginning elements of a British democracy, if the sheriff broke into your home and didn't have a right to do it, you know, you hadn't committed a crime, what did you do in merry old England? Well, you sued the sheriff, and you said, "Sheriff, you had no right to enter my home. I'm suing you personally for breaking and entering my house." Then the sheriff would present as a defense, the government said it was okay. So I didn't do it as a private citizen. I went in my official capacity as sheriff and arrested you. And so it's okay because I had a lawful order. And then you would challenge the lawfulness of the order and say, well, that's you don't have a legal right to arrest me. Therefore, you were just it's just pure battery. You put handcuffs on me. You carried me off. That's pure battery. But how do you get at the question of whether the state's criminal act against you, whether taking you away to jail, whether that was lawful or not? You had to sue the sheriff. Because in British law, the British state was sovereign. You couldn't sue the crown. So you sued the sheriff, and then you found out whether the sheriff had a right under the crown to arrest you or not. And that is a great legal practice. It's one that's been used by civil rights lawyers for many years thereafter, including in the United States. In other words, if you're being spied on and you try to sue Dick Cheney, he'll say, I'm the vice president, I didn't personally spy on you, and I don't have to tell you who did, and I leave me alone. State Secrets Act. It's a secret you have no right to find out. Go away. And you'll never find out, and he can just do as much unconstitutional spying as he wants. Not that it's legal or constitutional, but you can't challenge him. You can't bring it to courts. Because if you do, he'll say, well, I didn't sue, you know, go against you personally, and I'm the vice president, I'm too busy to find out who does, and it's state secrets and we're sovereign and go away. So you sue the telecommunications company. You sue the guy who tapped your wire. You sue the woman who was listening in to your phone conversation at Verizon or at AT&T or at wherever. I'm not picking on those companies particularly. And then the company says, well, wait, you know, okay, I tapped your line, but I was told to do it by the Bush administration. And then, and only then, can you challenge whether the Bush administration had a right to lawfully tap your line. So the question of telecommunications immunity really has nothing to do with telecommunications companies at all. If the Bush administration and the Republicans can protect the right of Verizon to tap your lines when the president tells Verizon to tap your lines, then what they're really saying is that the president has an absolute right to tap your lines. They're taking away the mechanism to challenge it in the courts. And that's something that I don't think Congress understands. Well, the Democrats mostly understand it. But I'm not so sure the people understand it. They're like, well, you know, it's not the communications company fault that the president told him to do illegal acts. I think it is. Quest Communications, to their praise from me, they refused. They said, Mr. President, I can't do this because it's not constitutional. And they didn't break the law. Now, here's my concern. The House has refused to pass telecommunications immunity. The Senate has its bill. They're going to need 60 votes. It looks like they don't have it, which is good, except that the Democrats have tried to extend everything for a month, this bill against the old Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. And the president has said no dice. He won't even give them a 30-day extension to figure out whether or not they're going to give him what he wants. He says, give me what I want now, or the bill, the whole thing will expire. And America will be open to terrorists. Well, Harry Reid, to his credit, the majority leader, is saying, then let it all expire. If it expires, what do we end up with? The same Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act we had before, where you have to get a warrant under the Constitution and the Fourth Amendment, and there's nothing wrong with that. I do fear, though, and I can tell you that my friends in the House of Representatives fear, that the Senate will cave in. They will cave into Bush's threats, and I would ask you to call your representative and call your senator. And call Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, and tell them to come home from the campaign trail, if they have to make sure that we don't give the telecommunications companies immunity to break the Constitution. Because giving them immunity gives George Bush the same immunity. Now, one last comment I want to talk today on a different subject. Although you're welcome to call in about anything I've discussed so far at 877-4-HEAD-ON. I want to talk about Gaza. There's a lot of analysts that are mentioning a humanitarian crisis in Gaza. What's going on in Gaza? Well, in Gaza, the Hamas dictatorship, and it is a dictatorship, even though they were elected by a plurality a few years back, they have banned all competing political parties. They have banned any free press. They have enforced not just their government, but they have removed from office anyone who is elected on a local level that doesn't support Hamas. Hamas may have achieved power through an election, just as Adolf Hitler achieved power through an election. But like Hitler, they have consolidated power and made sure that no one has any alternative views. Well, Hamas has been shooting hundreds of missiles a day into Israeli towns, most notoriously the town of Sderot. Now, this isn't disputed territory. This isn't the West Bank. This isn't Gaza. This is land that, under any international law, any way you cut it, belongs to Israel. And they shoot and they kill, most recently, an Ecuadorian man who was working in Sderot. And Israel responded. And Israel responded, frankly, the same way that we responded in Serbia in the mid-90s. They cut off electricity. They cut off fuel. In fact, they didn't have to bomb anything. We bombed Serbia in the 90s. All they did was say, sorry, you're not getting it from us. Electricity, fuel. So what did the Gazans do? Reasonably, they went to their other border. They went to the border with Egypt. And they knocked down the border fence. And all of this I found very interesting. Because why is it that the world expects Israel to provide Gaza with anything? With anything. Why should Israel provide Gaza with electricity? Why should Israel provide Gaza with food? Why don't the Arabs care about their Arab brothers? Why doesn't Egypt care about Gaza? Do you know the history of Gaza? Do you know how Gaza started? In 1947 of November, the United Nations voted to split the territory of Western Palestine. Eastern Palestine, the country of Transjordan, had already been given to the Arabs back in the 1920s. And in 1947, they voted to split it again with a Jewish state and an Arab state. None of the Arabs accepted the Arab state, and Egypt invaded the land that would become the Arab state, and they set up Gaza. And they are the ones who built the very refugee camps. They did not allow the Arabs of Gaza to become Egyptian citizens, even though they claimed Gaza as part of Egypt. They kept them in refugee camps, and they ruled with an iron fist. Indeed, they ruled Gaza much as they rule much of Egypt, which is a dictatorship ruled with an iron fist. Well, here's the question. Why can't Egypt take it over again? Egypt is getting billions of dollars from U.S. taxpayers as our supposed ally. Now, these are Arabs ruling over Arabs. Would it be a dictatorship? Of course it would, but every Arab country in the Middle East is a dictatorship, and many are worse than Egypt's. At least they could make sure that there's running water and fuel and food. Instead, the United States and Israel and the European Union are putting billions of dollars into Gaza, which just ends up going to Hamas. Not that much humanitarian aid goes through. Why are we in charge of Gaza? Why is Israel in charge of Gaza? Why is the United States in charge of Gaza? We have a country that's increasingly being owned by Saudi Arabia, being owned by the very sheikhs whose oil we are so dependent on. They have hundreds of billions of petrodollars that they have no place to put. Why won't the Arabs take care of their own? What, don't the wealthy sheikhs care about the Palestinian Arabs? Well, the answer, of course, is no. They've never cared about the Arabs. The reason why they keep the Gazan Arabs in misery is because they want them to shoot missiles into Israel. So what did Israel do? Israel ceased occupation entirely. They washed their hands of Gaza. They undid every single settlement there. They built a giant wall, and they said, bye-bye. And Gaza has continued the attack. Whatever our hopes for peace in the Middle East, and, you know, those hopes are not very great at the moment, probably won't be, actually, for several decades, nothing will ever bring peace in the Middle East if the people of Gaza can continue to shoot missiles into Israel. That is a violation of international law. Everyone agrees it's a violation of international law. What's interesting is that even on the left in Israel, they've come to an agreement. I was reading a quote recently by Chaim Ramon, who is the head of the labor movement, the left movement in Israel. And he said, quote, "We can live without peace with the Palestinians, but we can't continue to live with the occupation. We need to separate from them. We need to define our borders and tell them, bye-bye, go live however you want, and peace be with you. And if you want to keep fighting, we'll kill you until you stop." This is from the Israeli left, and I can't blame them. Israel is blamed for occupying territories, but when it ceases the occupation and the missiles continue to rain, somehow Israel is blamed for not giving humanitarian aid to the very enemies who are sending missiles into Israel. I think it's time for Egypt to fulfill the job. Egypt wanted Gaza in 1948. Egypt, at least it's Arabs ruling Arabs, which is what they want. If the Palestinians can't rule themselves without violence, Egypt can. Egypt has a peace treaty with Israel. It is a brutal dictatorship, that's true, but less brutal than others. Why can't Egypt step in and do what it needs to do? After all, Egypt caused the problem in the first place by now allowing a Palestinian Arab state. So I want you to think about that. If you want to call in on this or any other topic, we still have a few minutes left. The toll-free number is 877-4-HEAD-ON, 877-443-2366. Let me just conclude by talking a little bit about what's going to happen tomorrow. I, as you know, have been notoriously slow about announcing my endorsement for President of the United States. Well, I'm finally going to do it. Tomorrow, right here on the Head On Radio Network, you will hear my endorsement, all the thoughts that I had going into it, all the good for any of the candidates. And yeah, I guess you have one last chance to convince me, though at this point I think my mind's made up. I do think it's important to make my endorsement now. Now, you know, as if I were just of a voter, I would give it even more time. I'd look at the Democratic debate on Thursday, the 31st, the Republican debate on the 30th. But Super Tuesday's around the corner. Many of you live in Super Tuesday states, and I want to at least give my views to you and let you hear them and let you hear my thought process. Let me just say this for today. And no, obviously I'm not going to tell you who I'm going to endorse today. I'm telling you that tomorrow. But my thoughts for today are this. Let's make clear that whoever we support, whether it be Clinton, whether it be Obama, whether it be Edwards, or if you are a supporter of Kucinich who's left the race, or Dodd, or Biden, or Richardson who's left the race, let's make sure that we can all come together in November. That, above all, is my abiding concern. The differences between the three remaining candidates are very, very small. Certainly on issues, they have obviously different lives. There's different histories there. They have different personalities. But on issues, they're not that far apart. All of them would push this country towards more universal health care. All of them would begin to withdraw troops from Iraq. All of them believe that we can't just keep going into massive debt. We have to undo George Bush's tax cuts. All of them recognize that we've got to have an alternative energy, one that gets us off of foreign oil and at the same time starts to recognize the problems of climate change, which is growing increasingly a problem. The ice packs are melting even faster than you can imagine. Now, who would work with Republicans best? Who would keep progressive ideals best? Who does the media love? Who's played unfair in the campaign? All these are things that you're going to hear a lot about that you hear about every day. Just as the media can't help but raise issues of race and gender in the race with the first serious African-American candidate and female candidate for president. But please keep in mind that all three of these individuals are good people. They're all trying to do what's best for America. None of them are out to make a profit. All of them could make a lot more money in the private sector. All of them have devoted their lives to making a difference to the American people. There are differences among the three of them. We'll talk about those tomorrow. But please don't doubt that all three of them would make a terrific president. Leagues better. Not just than George W. Bush, but than Ronald Reagan, or George Herbert Walker Bush, or Mitt Romney, or John McCain, or Mike Huckabee, or Ron Paul, or Rudy Giuliani. So I don't have a problem with Democrats arguing who's best on this and who's best on that. Heck, that's what a primary is all about. But I hope we can all come together in the fall. And I will tell you this now. While I won't tell you my choice until tomorrow, I can tell you this. I hope that all three of them will have a major role in the next administration. One of them will be president. Perhaps one will be vice president. John Edwards, if he doesn't win, and I think it's increasingly unlikely that he will win, I have to tell you that. I don't think that's a secret for any of you. John Edwards would make a fine next Attorney General of the United States. They all have a role to play. Let's talk about it now. We're going to talk about it tomorrow. But let's all come together as one in November and finally make the State of the Union better. Finally end the scourge of the worst president of the United States. This is Mark Levine, signing off.